Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. Get in here, Ben. Let's do an intro.
Yes, let's do it.
All right. We're introing a podcast, and I'm joined by Ben. Christy is off dealing with her pastoring.
Yeah, she's got a job. She's got a regular job.
She's got a job. Whereas you and I.
We have a regular job, too, but we do. Gravity is a part-time gig for us. So
I just sit here perched on the edge of my seat with a microphone on my face waiting to do an intro once a week.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
That's all I do.
Yeah. Anyway, Christy, it is worth noting that Christy donates her time to be part of this podcast, and so that's why she can't always be with us. So,
and we appreciate that generosity.
For sure.
Well, we're in the full swing of summer around here, Ben. What do you like to do in the summer? What are your favorite, as an avid indoorsman?
Avid indoorsman.
You have a complicated relationship with something.
I do. The worst of the allergies, though, seem to be done. So it seems like spring is the worst season for me. Fall is kind of bad, but spring is the worst. But I've noticed I feel a little better. But I don't like the heat, you know, and it's starting to get hot here, so... What do I like to do? I typically take a couple weeks vacation over the summer. And I look forward to that. I look forward to taking a couple weeks off. I really like that. That's one thing I like doing.
That's good for you. What are you doing this evening, Ben?
Well, the evening that we are recording this podcast, my wife and I are going to enjoy an outdoor concert with some friends of ours. So,
yeah, you like that.
I do. I do enjoy going to shows. And there's a lot more of them over the summer. There's a few good like outdoor venues here in Indianapolis that I enjoy frequenting, going to concerts, rock concerts.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. I'll be at that show tonight.
Oh yeah.
Did you know that?
Yeah. Oh, you know what? Maybe you guys were the friends that we were going to meet up with. I was just trying to remember. That was it.
Check your diary. I enjoy summer as well. My watch tells me that I have increased the steps per day exponentially. So I typically take my dog for a nice long 2-mile walk early in the morning when I wake up. And I don't do that when it's like under like 40 degrees. I'm just a kind of a sissy, kind of a wimp.
Yeah, you need it to be a little
kind of a wimp when it comes to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I like to do lots of walks, and I enjoy being warm.
Yeah, more than I do.
Yeah, more than I enjoy being cold.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, I've heard of people like you.
Men. Yeah, we are. Yeah, here I am. We are also going on a couple trips this summer, which I'm excited about, including some friends invited us to come to their lake house. This is like, it's crazy. My son's girlfriend's best friend's boyfriend.
Oh gosh, wait.
You following this?
Girlfriend's.
My son's girlfriend's best friend's boyfriend. Okay. He came and hung out on my back patio several weeks ago. And in the course of conversation, it came out that his dad's best friend is a fraternity brother of mine from college.
Oh.
And that fraternity brother lives in Atlanta and is coming in town this weekend. And the dad of the boyfriend of the best friend of my son's girlfriend was like, hey, you should invite the Tebbies because Matt's fraternity brother is going to be in town and he wants to see him. So I got a lake house invite from my son's girlfriend's best friend's boyfriend's dad because he's good friends with my fraternity brother.
that's really funny. That's like however, 6 degrees of separation right there.
Yeah. Yeah. However you can get the lake house invite.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't even matter.
The lake house. That's the dream. That's the dream. So
what is one of the American dreams? Yeah. Let's go ahead and pivot into our interview today because we are talking to Pastor Munther Isaac, who is a Palestinian theologian who serves as a pastor of the Hope Evangelical Lutheran Church in Ramallah in the West Bank. He also is the director of Bethlehem Institute for Peace and Justice, which is a part of the Bethlehem Bible College, and the director of the highly acclaimed Christ at the Checkpoint Conferences. Today, we're chatting with him about his latest book, Christ in the Rubble, Faith, the Bible, and the Genocide in Gaza. Let's get into this. All right. Munther Isaac, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We are recording this within 24, 48 hours of some heightened conflict between Israel and Iran. And even over here in the States, we're kind of on pins and needles trying to figure out what's going to happen. So just from where you are, maybe give us a personal update about how you're doing and what things are like there in Ramallah.
Yeah, so I'm speaking to you from Ramallah in the West Bank. Just recently moved there, actually. It's been a week. And the first day we moved, Israel began its attack on Iran, and then Iran retaliated and hit back. We're watching with concern. Actually, we see the missiles in the sky every time they are fired. And we hear sounds of, the interception of these missiles. We hear huge bombs, sometimes homes shake, sometimes debris fall, actually, on Palestinian areas. We all have loved ones, Palestinians in Israel, who are relatives to us. So we're concerned about everything that's happening. And we're fearful that this could even escalate more. Let's not forget that this is all happening in the midst of the war on Gaza. This has not ended. So it's been more than a year and a half of constant violence, killing, death. We're still praying that it stops. Every life lost is a loss. And at the same time, here at the West Bank, we live in severe siege around our cities. Movement is difficult. Checkpoints define our reality. But on top of that, now you have this psychological fear and sleepless nights as a result of all of that. So we're praying we're very, very concerned at this time.
Yes, Munther. For those of us who are less familiar with the geography and the socio-political sort of lines that have been drawn in Palestine and Israel, could you give us a brief description of the West Bank and its relationship to both the state of Israel and Palestine, Gaza?
Yeah, first let's remember everything is very small, especially when compared with the mass land you have in the United States. So, for example, Tel Aviv is probably a 30 minutes drive from here, We can see the lights of Tel Aviv from Ramallah easily. So when you think of the geography, the land is very, very small and everything is close to one another. Gaza is probably an hour and a half drive from where I am right now. The West Bank is at the heart of the land called Palestine / Israel, you know, whatever you want to call it. To us, it's Palestine. And at the heart of this land, there is this area called the West Bank, occupied after 1967. And that land includes, of course, the eastern part of Jerusalem. And Israel, throughout the years since 1967, but more so after the peace agreements, the so-called peace agreements, the Oslo deals, have fragmented this very small land by building settlements. Settlements are Israeli. They begin as small towns and they become big cities at the heart of the West Bank. And the result is fragmenting the land. So to leave Ramallah, I have to go through Israeli-controlled roads and Israeli-controlled areas. And right now, every Palestinian area is completely besieged with checkpoints, blocks. And to go from one area to the other, you need to go through an Israeli checkpoint. This means, you know, a trip that should take me 40 minutes to go from one place to the other could take anything from 2 to 4 to 5 to 6 hours if the checkpoint is delayed or even closed. And so life for us as Palestinians in the West Bank is we are literally suffocated in very concentrated areas, densely populated areas. And the Israeli community or the Israeli settlements are growing rapidly around us. And there is a wall that separates us from the Israeli side, but also there is a system of roads that, as I said, help create this reality of fragmentation. You really have to come and see to understand what we're talking about. Yeah. And again, for the sad reality for most pilgrims who used to come before the war began in 2023, is that they don't see any of this. They just stay on the Israeli-controlled land, Israeli-controlled areas, and cannot understand the difficulties Palestinians face just to go from one place to the other. And I'm not even talking about going from one Palestinian place to another Israeli place, just talking from one Palestinian place to another.
Yeah. And we're going to get into that here as you sort of elucidate in your book, Christ in the Rubble. But maybe we can back up a bit, Munther, and I wonder if you could give us just a brief biological sketch as a Palestinian Christian. Were you always a Christian? Where were you born and raised? And how did you come to write this book about what's happening in Palestine?
Of course, I've always been a Christian, you know. When did we convert? Actually, we became Christians on the day of the Pentecost. The first church was in Jerusalem. And actually, we exported Christianity to the United States. That's one of our most, proud of, the fact that Christianity started from Jerusalem. And I'm still shocked that people are surprised to know that Palestinian Christians exist. I mean, it should be a surprise if we did not exist, given that Christianity started. So there has always been a Christian presence in this land. And there was a time when we were the majority, and obviously now we are, unfortunately, a tiny minority, yet an important part of the Palestinian people. So we're Palestinians. We view ourselves as the indigenous people of the land. We can trace our lineage to hundreds of years, sometimes more than that, of living in this land. I'm talking about, you know, families. I can go back with my own family and see when they lived and settled in the Bethlehem area and so on. But as I said, the Christian presence itself is as old as the first church. Part of life here is, yes, this is the Holy Land, the biblical land, if you wish. But to us, this is home. And this is a place of where we grew up in. This is where we have our rootedness, memories, stories, everything. Yet at the same time, it's a place that is marked with a very, very difficult political reality, a reality of wars, apartheid, and oppression. Especially since 1948 for us, when Israel was created. Again, this is the myth that many people have, that Israel was created on an empty land. You know, Israel was not created on an empty land. The Jewish settlers who came to Palestine had to empty most of Palestine and ethnically cleanse half of the people, including many Christians, by the way, to establish the state of Israel. So we're the survivors who were not expelled in 1948. By the way, more than half of the Palestinians were forced to leave Palestine in 1948, including, as I said, many, many Christians, you know, at least 50,000 Christians. Hmm. So we survived in our homes by God's grace, and we continued the Christian presence, and we continued to be as part of the Palestinian people. The book you mentioned, Christ in the Rubble, is my recent book. I am a pastor. I belong to the Lutheran tradition. It is a Protestant/evangelical tradition. You know, we confuse Americans when they come and try to put us in a box that fits their divisions in the United States between liberal and conservative, and it's hard to put us in one box, to be honest. And so as a pastor in Bethlehem, I'm trying to answer the questions of my people. And this is what got me to write, whether it's The Other Side of the Wall or the books I write in Arabic or the sermons I give, trying to make sense of faith. What does it mean? And how does our faith help us to live under apartheid, under watching a genocide unfold in front of our eyes and feeling powerless to stop it? So Christ in the Rubble is the product of my ministry as a pastor back then in Bethlehem, when I was the pastor of the Christmas Lutheran Church. Whether it's the sermons, the activism that I've been doing to elevate the plight of Palestinians and to challenge the dominant one-sided narrative that misses the point that we see in the West, especially among Christians. And if I'm honest, yeah, it's actually part of the reason why I wrote this book and I began, talking and writing and with many of my colleagues about Gaza, is we were troubled by what Christians were saying about the war. I mean, at least talk to us. At least talk to us before giving these horrible comments or insights about a war that obviously you don't know nothing about.
Hmm. Yeah.
We'll be right back. The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
Speaking of things that we misunderstand here in the United States, I wonder if you can talk. It's very common, especially nowadays, as people, becoming more and more active just in politics in general, just because of Trump and all this, other stuff that's happened here. There's a lot of talk, though, among pastors in the United States that basically says we should not be involved in politics, right? The pastor's job is to tend to spiritual matters, you know, tend your flock, give pastoral care, you know, do that kind of thing, but don't get too political or don't make an idol out of politics. And so there's this, you know, just like you talked about the dichotomy between liberal and conservative. I think we also have this dichotomy maybe between like pastoral ministry and political activism. But right in the intro of your book, you say that in Palestine, addressing the political challenges we face daily is a pastoral call. And so I wonder if you can elaborate on maybe how you see politics, I'm putting that in scare quotes for our listeners, how you see politics and how you, as a pastor, relate to those political issues.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that many times those who insist that we should as if separate politics from spiritual issues are usually very politically opinionated and involved, and yet lecture others on not getting into politics when our involvement does not fit their own ideology or framework. To me, as a Palestinian pastor, I'm just honestly trying to address the needs of my people. And those who know me know that I grew up in a very conservative, actually, evangelical tradition that actually taught me that we should not talk politics. And I really find it ironic, and I think God has a sense of humor, because growing up as a young man, I resented politics. And I said, there is no way I would, this is wrong, this is stuff of the world, to talk about, you know, political issues, intifada, Palestinians, and so on. And the more I got, the deeper I got into the teachings of Jesus, actually, the more I realized that I cannot avoid, actually, this is what Jesus did. And so what got me into all of this is actually not, you know, a political interest as much as it is a deeper understanding of the teachings of Jesus. And then when I became a pastor in my church in Bethlehem, the same in my church right now in Ramallah, the needs, the challenges people face are mainly political, so-called political. You know, whether it's land confiscation, the checkpoints, the family reunions, the family civil affairs. I mean, I could talk for hours about how complicated, but how much Israel have control of our lives through a system that, you know, where you register, you know, Palestinians have several ID cards. There is the West Bank, there is East Jerusalem, there is Gaza, there is the refugees, there is those with Israeli passport, and everyone has a different status. I mean, this is how Israel controlled us, by dividing us and marrying from one category into another, even though we're one people. Is so complicated. You need lawyers, you need papers. To the extent that, you know, a Palestinian from Bethlehem marrying, for example, a foreign spouse, or, you know, Palestinian from Ramallah marrying a foreign spouse, that means you need approval and a visa from the Israelis for your spouse to live with you. And actually, some of my good friends were forced to leave Palestine because Israel would not grant their spouse's visa. This is how much control Israel have over our lives. And so, as I always say, imagine if when people come to me with these challenges that they are facing, and my response is, I'm sorry, I don't talk politics. It's a silly argument, to be honest. You can't avoid it. And you have to, at the same time, show that faith helps us respond. Show that the nonviolent teachings of Jesus actually are the answer to our world. And they're not just naive, ideal teachings, that they can make a difference if we truly believe them. And that we have to show and embody an alternative to the world and preach that, but also embody it. So you have to empower people with the fact that your faith actually has the answers to these challenges. Not just in the sense that God is my refuge, and surely God is our refuge. Not just in the sense that God watches over us, or that, you know, just preach about it. When you're afraid, read the Psalms, make sure that you turn to God. But at the same time, you know, what answers to give to our broken world? That's another element that we should definitely address as Christians. When people come to us with these challenges, with these questions that they are facing, otherwise we leave the arena for the voices of either the extremists or the voices of those who believe might is right, which is what we are witnessing today in our world. We have to, as if not just provide answers, but challenge the monopoly of power of those who just tell us that might is right or tell us our way is the only way. And we have to show that the kingdom of God provides an alternative to all of the above.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the, I want to get into more of the theology that drives your ministry, Munther. But first, I think one of the things that's so helpful about your book is that it addresses, and you've already named some myths and some misunderstandings, and even like, you know, myths and misunderstandings can be innocent mistakes, but there's also active disinformation and propaganda that confuses, I think, well-meaning people to not really understand what's going on in Palestine. One of the decisions you make, it's right there in the subtitle, and you give reasons for this in the book, is that you're calling what's happening a genocide. And you use words, even in this interview, like ethnic cleansing, you use the word apartheid. Could you maybe help us understand why you think the word genocide is an accurate description of what's happening?
Yeah. So, you've read the book and you've seen that every word I use or every description, I'm not just throwing these words without explaining them or defending them. So you have to explain what. And these are not just my words. These are definitions or internationally agreed upon descriptions of realities that I'm using because they fit what's happening in Palestine. And to be clear, I did not invent the term genocide, nor did Palestinians. And we did not write the definitions or the criteria of what a genocide is and what a genocide is not. These are things that the our collective humanity, if I may say this, decided on. We came together, honestly, basically to say never again, especially after not just the horrors of the Second World War, but precisely the Holocaust. And to decide never again should mean never again. And this is the definition of what a genocide is. And then there is a list. It's called the Genocide Convention. There is a list of four categories that define what a genocide is. And all you have to do is ask yourself, does the definition fit what Israel is doing? And then in the book, I don't just bring my own testimony as if, but the testimony of the experts, namely the genocide scholars that are everywhere in universities around the world. By the way, including Israeli Jewish scholars in the Hebrew University itself. I'm not talking about liberal Jews, just I'm talking about, you know, who all agree, yes, what we are committing in Gaza is a genocide. The same with ethnic cleansing, the same with apartheid. All of these are internationally agreed upon definitions. And in the book, I'm trying to show something that the real question is not whether this is genocide or not, or whether what's happening is an apartheid or not. The real question is why does the world continue to avoid recognizing what's happening in Palestine first as apartheid and now as a genocide.
Yes.
That is the real scandal. The fact that despite the mounting evidence that I tried to show in the book, but then, and by the way, since I've written the book, more and more evidence, I mean, just what's happening in the last month with the denial of food, that is, you know, a clear war crime, human rights violation. Yes. The fact that the world continues to ignore it is the real scandal, is the real question. And to me, as a man of faith, the fact that the church in particular keeps ignoring or fails to call what's happening a genocide, it's an assault on our humanity, because you create these human rights, but then when it comes to the Palestinians, as if these rights don't apply on us, are we less humans? So yeah. To me, it's a very serious issue.
Yeah, you cover multiple myths and multiple sort of disinformation or propaganda in your book. But the two that I would love to hear your responses to here as an example of what you cover in the book is two powerful pieces of propaganda are any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. And if you support Palestinians, you are pro-Hamas. How do you respond to those? And not just with facts, but have you found a way to appeal to people who believe those things in ways that help move them to greater clarity and truth?
I think we have, you're right. There's one. First of all, we have to talk about the facts. For example, that the, you know, the majority of Palestinians are not Hamas. They don't support Hamas. And that Palestinians have been resisting the occupation and trying to obtain independence and self-determination and freedom long before Hamas was even created. And at the same time, you know, we have to call out the shameful weaponization of anti-Semitism. And when it comes to anti-Semitism, one of the things that shocks me is how strong narratives can be in shaping realities, false narratives, I mean. Because today, if you talk to the normal Christian, American, white, if you wish, person about what is the biggest threat Jews face, who is the biggest danger to Jews, they would immediately say, well, it's Arabs, Muslims. That's where anti-Semitism is. And the reason, you know, this shocks me is, you know, how strong this narrative must have been to the extent that it made the world forget that it was actually European Christians who butchered 6 million Jews just, what, 70 years ago? 80 years ago? And the fact that all of this seems to now to be forgotten, and all of a sudden the white person, the white European American, is the one who defends the sanctity of life and all of that, whereas Arabs and Muslims are the evil, you know, this shows you the power of narrative. Yeah. Distorting reality. So when people throw this accusation of anti-Semitism on us, I have to say, honestly, I mean, you have the audacity to call Palestinians anti-Semites when it was your tradition that led to the, you know, evil, brutal massacre of 6 million Jews, the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And now you're calling us, really, for simply resisting the attempts to push us out of our land. That's our crime. And as I said, to weaponize that is truly shameful. And then to apply that even, and here is where it becomes not just confusing, even beyond that, when you have Jews who are today on the front line of speaking for the rights of Palestinians and challenging Zionism. And then they create these terms, self-hating Jews. And when I think of Christians who are now making arguments or decisions on who's a good Jew and who's a bad Jew, and if you're a Zionist Jew, you're a good Jew. If you're not a Zionist, if you're an anti-Zionist Jew, you're a bad Jew. To me, that's the real anti-Semitism we should fight. And similarly, you know, the idea, as I talk in the book, the idea that whether it's Biden or Trump, and I was very deliberate when I talked on anti-Semitism to highlight two examples of both. Yeah. First, when, you know, Biden would say, if Israel did not exist, we would have to create it to protect our interest. You're actually admitting of using Jews to defend your own interest.
Yeah.
And then when he said Jews will never be safe, you know, only in Israel. So you're basically saying, you know, we will not protect Jews. Jews cannot feel at home in the United States. This is not their home. They have to go, you know, isn't that anti-Semitic? Yes. And then the different, you know, not just stereotypes, but, you know, when Trump says he blamed the Jews if he would fail the elections and so on. And you're calling Palestinians anti-Semites, you know, all these stereotypes that you're creating. So it's really important not just to talk about facts. And by the way, those who know me know that I'm always intentional and clear that we should be careful in our language, because anti-Semitism does exist. And equating, you know, the Jews did that or Jews always do that, these kind of accusations do exist. We should reject that. We should fight that. And I will be, you know, of course, unfortunately, I say this, I recognize that some of the demonstrations or the voices within the Free Palestine movement have within them anti-Semitic tones. We should challenge that. But to characterize everything as anti-Semitic or the cause as anti-Semitic, that is the issue. And that's what we should, you know, go deeper into the motives behind it. Why are you saying this? What's the reason behind it? And help people understand, as I said, what's behind all of this.
Yeah. You mentioned Christian Zionism. I wonder if we can double click on that a little bit, because that's it's an unusually powerful, you know, you talked about false narratives, and there's a powerful theology that a lot of American Christians have sort of absorbed, that, you know, can be labeled Christian Zionism, you know, this belief that there is a biblically mandated return of the Jewish people to the Holy Land, and this is a necessary precursor to the second coming of Christ. And so I think there's a theology that runs in the background of a lot of American Christians that basically says, like, well, we can't challenge the state of Israel because this is prophecy, and, you know, this is the eschatological fulfillment of the second coming of Christ and all that kind of thing. I wonder if you can just name, like, what are some of the theological flaws you see in that position?
It's much more than flaws, Benjamin. It's much worse than that.
That's true.
To begin with, the assumption that we have to, that the Bible determines who owns the land. Do you know what I mean? As if, you know, is there any other context in which we solve a dispute by going to a religious text and asking, does the deity promise this land to a certain tribe? And then who's actually the descendants of this tribe, and then apply this? I mean, just think of what Christian Zionists are saying. Many times when I talk to them, I say, are you listening to yourselves? Imposing your religious beliefs on millions of people with arrogance, because you know better. And again, here is the irony. It's the same people who preach about the separation of state and religion. Yet here they are shoving it in our face. Not just that, imposing it on us. This is not your land, because we know that God gave it to someone else thousands of years ago. And again, the power of this false narrative is a Jew born in Brooklyn is now more entitled to come and live in the land, even displace a Palestinian, because God says so. And again, I say, are you listening to yourself when you use these terms, Jews returning to their land? And again, the simplicity, the naivety in it, as if, you know, you can draw a straight line between Jews of today and the biblical people, and as if nothing happened 2,000 years since Jesus was in this land and so on. Let alone the fact that, you know, do you read the New Testament? Do you read Jesus? Do you read Paul about who are the offspring of Abraham? Who inherits the promises? Is it by ethnicity? Is God racist? Does God teach exceptionalism? And, you know, a friend of mine who's American said, you know, maybe it's because Americans failed to find anything that taught, you know, in the Bible that talked about American exceptionalism. And, you know, American exceptionalism is so important to you guys. I'm not sure you realize this. And maybe, you know, you're looking for something in the Bible about it, but you can't find it. So you find Israeli Jewish exceptionalism, and then you link to that. And if you bless Israel, God will bless you. And, you know, in my first book, The Other Side of the Wall, I unpack all of this. And some of the statements that actually come from evangelical leaders are so telling, you know. And by the way, it's not only evangelical leaders, it's many times politicians, you know, of Israel and America being the only two countries in the world with a direct relationship to God. You know, this is the essence of Christian Zionism, exceptionalism. entitlement, privilege. And then when you apply this in a political discourse with violence, even to the extent of justifying violence, that's the most horrific thing. And that's when, you know, that's what led to the things I talked about in the book about evangelicals calling for the destruction of Gaza, for the killing of thousands of people, even calling for, you know, using nuclear weapon against Palestinians. These are Christians, and it shocks us, this obsession with violence. So it's not just flawed. And I wish it was a matter of let's read the Bible and see if there is interpretation. You know, as I said, we've written about this. My PhD, by the way, was in the theology of the promised land. If you want, you know, to ask, does God, to whom did God give the land? Why did he promise? I mean, we've written a lot about it. But we need to go deeper than that. Are you listening to yourself, applying this political, you know, imposing your religious beliefs on others, beliefs about exceptionalism, privilege, and entitlement?
And now, a word from a sponsor.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even. Like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations, because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
There's so much in this book. I think one of the gifts, Munther, is that it provides historical context that heretofore has been really hard to get our minds around. It seems like, for instance, in the October 7th attack, it's interpreted in a vacuum, right? As though that was the first thing that happened. And so your book is really helpful to hold the history and the struggle together. You know, I've recommended the 100 Years War on Palestine by Rashid Khalidi, because I think it does a good job, but it's work to get through that, you know, and I think your book does a similar work in a more accessible way. But at the end of the book, you turn towards our call as Christians. And you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, I wonder if we could close with this, that you're committed to nonviolent opposition of apartheid and genocide. Can you give us tangible, concrete ideas about what that means for you, maybe on a day-to-day basis or a week-to-week basis? How does that show up in your life and in the life of your church?
Yeah. And to be clear, I'm not being noble here or too ideal or whatever you want to call me by talking about nonviolence. I'm basically following Jesus. Yeah. To us as Palestinian Christians, nonviolence is part and parcel of being Christian. It's in the package deal. You can't be Christian and not be nonviolent. It's very obvious, which is what shocks me, that
yes,
we still have to argue for it. What that means is it's a lifestyle of a commitment, first of all, to love, to neighbors. Nonviolent is actually, I don't like the word because it's passive. It gives the impression of passivity. So, let's unpack it more. It's about, you know, commitment to love neighbor as self and commitment to love even the enemy. Loving the enemy means seeking to liberate them, turning them into friends, challenging the wrongdoings, even calling for accountability. And always fighting against the dehumanization of others. Was talking respectfully about even those who with whom you disagree, always finding to find common grounds. And at the same time, it's about finding creative means to resist evil with good. That's a biblical commandment, to resist evil with good, Romans 12, 21. Mm-hmm. And to do that, it depends from one context to the other. There is an important document called the Kairos Palestine document. And in that document, the document talks about creative resistance. And they talk about creativity because, as I said, it's from, you know, it's about seeing the image of God in the other, seeking ways to turn the others into the enemy into a friend. And I love the word creative because you have to think contextually about how do I resist evil in my context without demonizing or dehumanizing the opponent, as if. In our context, this could be civil disobedience, which is what we've done in certain times of our struggle. It could be marches. It could be strikes. It could be boycotting Israeli goods. And today, when it comes to what's happening in Palestine, to me, the solution to everything that's happening lies in if we come together, first as people of faith, that's my hope, and then as ground grassroots movements, and call for accountability. When people tell me, how do you think the conflict can be solved? To me, it's very simple. And two words, by the way, weapon embargo. Believe me, that will force Israel to come to the table and decide, okay, let's find a way to share the land with the Palestinians who live in it. You know, there's the same number of people. Israel right now believes that they can eliminate us. Why do they believe so? They're never held accountable for committing war crimes.
Right.
And it's not exhausting their bill. You know, you guys are paying it. American taxpayers are paying for most of this. And I've been saying this since the beginning of the war. We've been saying it for a long time.
Yeah.
We've written about it. Israel will continue to do what it's doing, fueled by radical religious ideologies or radical Zionist ideologies, if you wish. And Israel today is clearly controlled by very extreme radical leaders, from Netanyahu to all those around him. They will continue to try to eliminate Palestinians and fight against either a Palestinian state or sharing the land because no one is holding them accountable.
Right.
And because they continue to get support from the rest of the world, especially the United States. When these two things change, I will have hope. And until then, we just have to stay. To us, we resist by simply existing in this land and continuing to stay and fight all the efforts to force us to leave. And to me, maybe if I say this in the end, as a Christian, this is, I feel the double weight of this responsibility, not leaving, continuing the Christian presence, to continuing this way of Jesus in this land where it all started. And at the same time, remembering that the kingdom of God is all about these small seeds that we plant. It's never about the big. So I'm never distracted by our numbers, by, as I said, this is what I said actually on Sunday in our church. Every small act of good, of love, makes a difference in our world. Let's not think, how can we stop this war between Israel and Iran? We prayed for this. We're doing advocacy for it. But what's the small act of goodness, of love, that I can do tomorrow that will make our world a better place? This is the way of Jesus. If you call it nonviolent, then I'm happy with that.
The book again is Christ in the Rubble, Faith, the Bible, and the Genocide in Gaza. Munther, as we go here, where can people find your other speaking and writing online?
Follow me on my social media, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And I also, so there is Munther Isaac, and I encourage you to follow the YouTube channel of Christ at the Checkpoint. And also the podcast Across the Divide. I'm using that platform. It's called Across the Divide Broadcast. to elevate voices of other Palestinian Christians of, with whom I have conversations about life, about reality in Palestine, whether it's Christian Zionism or so on. So Across the Divide podcast is another way, place where you can find us.
Munther, we join you in longing for the violence to stop, for peace to reign, for self-determination for Palestinians, for Jewish people to feel safe as well in Israel. And we thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Ben. Ben, did you know about the issues confronting the Palestinians before we talked to...
I had never even heard of Palestine before that interview.
All joking aside, because it's such a difficult situation. What are some thoughts here? What are you left with?
The two things I was struck with, something he said near the end. Well, two things he said near the end. One was that we resist by continuing to exist. We resist by continuing to exist. I don't know. There's just something about that that was really striking for me. Like, we're going to just be here and continue to exist in this land. Because part of what they're trying to do is, you know, say that you don't belong here and you need to go somewhere else. You know, that's part of the ethnic cleansing. And so part of their resistance, I don't know, just felt very clear to me. Like, part of our resistance is we're here. We exist. We insist on our humanity.
Yeah, this is, it reminded me of Jesus's teaching in the Sermon on the Mount about turning the other cheek and going the extra mile. Mm. At least both of those are asserting the dignity of the oppressed.
Right.
As a way of resisting evil.
Right.
And it seems like when Munther said that we are determined to continue to exist, there is a commitment to the dignity of Palestinian lives that is a part of nonviolent resistance.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I really, that struck me, I think, for that reason. And then the other thing that struck me, you know, we talked a little bit about the political, kind of the spiritual political divide that we have here and how it feels so transgressive to sort of get involved in politics and specific policies and, you know, all of that kind of thing. And just how, like, somebody like Munther, who's on the ground involved in a colonial apartheid, you know, oppressive, he's under the boot, right, of this apartheid regime, and how clear it is for someone like him that his call as a pastor and it could be to say something like, you know, the political policy that needs to change is the U.S. needs to stop providing Israel with military weapons.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. You know, it's like, it's so clear. It's not like, oh, this is really complicated and who knows how to resolve this conflict and it goes back centuries and, like, that all is true, obviously. But for him, it's so clear that what would force a negotiation would be for the U.S. to stop propping up Israel with military weapons.
Yeah, I mean, when I did Evangelicals for Harris online Zoom event, this is one of the issues that I spoke about and took, you know, took umbrage with Harris that she needed to stop funding the genocide in Palestine.
Yes.
Stop spending money on weapons that are killing and starving children.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an indictment on the Christianity of the West that we take more issue with feeding hungry kids in our country via SNAP or USAID, et cetera, then that's more morally egregious to us politically than it is to pay for bombs that kill kids and starve kids in Palestine.
Yeah. And, you know, I was struck too just by the bipartisan nature of of this atrocity.
Oh,
you know
what I mean? Propaganda, like, is strong, man. It's wrapped up in America.
It is. It's wrapped up in America, and it's not a Republican or Democrat thing. I mean, Biden was just as bad an offender as any other president, you know?
Yep.
And in his sort of unwavering support for this regime that's, you know, according to the people on the ground, committing genocide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had slightly more hope that there wouldn't be an escalation of violence under Harris or Biden, but their policies were just as dehumanizing to Palestinians.
Yeah.
And wrapped up in American supremacy, that the supremacy of Israel and America, the state of Israel and the state of America are very closely linked. Something else I was thinking, Ben, you know, when you and I were speaking out against like pastor abuse in the church, mm-hmm. or against Christian nationalism, people who were in our circles would accuse us of being anti-American, hating this country, or hating pastors, hating the church.
Right.
And I think it's not a perfect analogy, but it's analogous in some ways to criticizing the state of Israel and being accused of being anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think there's a confusion here between the nation state and an ethnic people.
Right.
That's one issue. The other issue is, you can critique an ideology inside of a group, whether it's America or Christians, mm-hmm. or Israel, without demonizing the entire group.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you think the ideology is demonizing. You think the ideology is problematic to those people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right? But this is what ideology does, I think, is it refuses to separate itself from the people, right? The ideology becomes the idol that you have to defend at all costs. Mm. I mean, I'm reminded of that Thomas Merton quote. He said, when I criticize a system, they think I criticize them. And that, of course, is because they fully accept the system and identify themselves with it.
Yes.
Like that's it, they don't have any other way to hear it besides you're being anti-America or anti-Semitic, because they fully accept that ideology and fully identify themselves with it. And so it feels egregious or like a personal attack to say such things.
Yes. Yeah, anyway. I want to point out something too that he mentioned. He mentioned sort of the true anti-Semitism that Trump has repeated, right? And the anti-Semitism that tends to live in MAGA, talking about globalists and things like this, right?
Right.
Hollywood cabal.
The anti-Semitism that he pointed out that Biden confessed as well. You know what I mean?
Yes. But in particular, a lot of pro-Israel people mm-hmm. come from sort of the MAGA ranks.
Sure.
And I have Jewish friends in the States who took issue with me calling out Jewish Zionism. And it seemed to me to be that their definition of Zionism was different than the way that Zionism is extolled and extended in Israel. So I didn't want to quibble over that word, but I did ask both of them, like, are you curious about why people who tolerate the most anti-Semitic things mm-hmm. in the United States mm-hmm. are the most pro-Israel?
Right.
Does that bother you, or does that make you curious at all? And both of them were like, yeah, that's weird. And I'm like, I think it's more than weird.
Right. It's not, yeah.
You know?
Aren't you curious about the connection?
Yeah. In those conversations, though, I was very committed to not, it's not my job. I don't feel like it's my job to argue with a Jewish person about how they feel about the Israel-Palestinian conflict. Mm-hmm. I've got enough on my hands trying to collect Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I think you are. I think you do have enough on your hands.
I do.
Yeah. Well, it's sobering too, just to sort of, it was just reminded this is real. These are real people's lives, you know. I think living in relative distance from all these things where this all just, I don't know, there's something tier two just about like all of this stuff happens via the screen for us. You know what I mean? Like we know about this stuff from our phones and from news reports and from media, and we're looking at it all through the screen. And there's something about that that does tend to sort of make it seem unreal, which I was, so it's just, I guess it's just sobering to talk to somebody who's, oh, you're actually living through this.
Yeah.
And I mean, the number of times he said, come over and visit us, I thought was really striking as well.
Yeah. So we did ask him.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ben. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, he's like, that's, you know, that's what you can do. Come and be with us. Come and stay with us. Come and see how things are for us. And there's something there too that is, I think something like that is probably what it takes to sober us up, to wake us up to the reality of it. Because it's, I think we become so desensitized to things that happen through the screen that, like, you know, it feels unreal.
Yep.
Through the screen.
Yeah, we did ask him after we stopped recording, just what are some helpful things that you can invite Western people into who want to do things? And he mentioned one, come and visit,
right?
Which, I don't know, feels scary to me, like visiting them right now.
Safe?
Right. You know?
Yeah.
But I think being there, like he's right, being in an apartheid state with checkpoints and walls and military and degradation, I think you experience things differently. Two, he said, support indigenous ministries. So support Palestinian Christian ministries financially, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. And three, he said, lobby politically for ceasefire.
Yeah.
And I think I'm committed to that.
Yes.
Yes. So those are three things that Munther said on the way out that we can do, friends.
Yep. And the ceasefire, to be clear, would come through the U.S. refusing to send any more weapons to Israel.
Yeah.
Like that's the policy for us to advocate for here. So.
Yeah. Ben, I don't know if I want to end on a dad joke with this.
I don't. Yeah, I feel that.
You feel that?
I feel that. I feel that maybe we shouldn't do that today.
But that also means maybe we should.
Yeah, I don't know, 50-50. I'm thinking it's 50-50 that you're going to do it.
It's almost, I think it's like 65-35 now.
Mm. The more we talk about it.
All right, here we go. What's the difference between, I'm going to run with it. What's the difference between wallpaper and toilet paper?
I think I've heard this one, but I can't remember the punchline.
Do you know?
I don't know.
Gross.
Gross. I think there's another punchline. Is this the same joke where it's like, so you're
I also
the one.
I did a similar one with toilet paper and a shower curtain.
That's right. That's right.
I think those are funny. And now everybody knows that there is a 13 and a half year old boy in me that won't stop laughing at poop jokes.
Yep. There's something universal about it, I think.
Universal. I don't know. That might be overspeaking. I think there's three people that appreciate it. Mm. Anyway, listener, we'll hang with you next time.
Peace, friends.
See you. Oh, man.
That's you, bro. You have to stop it.
I guess. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.